Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 28 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet and sculptor Pascal Petit explores the catharsis she experiences by transforming trauma into art, and the poet and biographer Julia Coppice considers the impact of serious illness on the life of the creative artist. First up, here's Pascal Petit with Transforming Trauma.
I'm going to talk about turning my personal experience of child abuse into poems. How I tried to transform what are unspeakable experiences into art that hopefully doesn't scare the reader away. I'll refer to two of my books, The Zoo Father, written in 2001, and Fauvery, written in 2014. They're both about my father, who made contact after having vanished for 35 years. I hadn't seen him since I was 8. Let's start with a poem, one of the gentler ones. It's set in Paris, where I discovered that my father was living. He was hooked to an oxygen concentrator machine because he had emphysema. This is the opening poem from The Zoo Father. The Straitjackets. I lay the suitcase on father's bed and unzip it slowly, gently. Inside, packed in cloth straitjackets, lie 40 live hummingbirds, tied down in rows, each tiny head cushioned on a swaddled body. I feed them from a flask of sugar water, inserting every bill into the pipette, then unwind their bindings so father can see their changing colours as they dart around his room. They hover inches from his face as if he's a flower, their humming just audible above the oxygen recycler. For the first time since I've arrived, he's breathing easily. The cannula attached to his nostrils almost slips out. I don't know how long we sit there, but when I next glance at his face, he's asleep, lights from their feathers still playing on his eyelids and cheeks. It takes me hours to catch them all and wrap them in their straitjackets. I work quietly. He's in such a deep sleep, he doesn't wake once. I'm often accused of being a magical realist or surrealist. These hummingbirds in a suitcase do seem rather surreal, but they're very real. I wrote the poem after seeing a photo in an old Time Life book. I came across the picture of the hummingbirds swaddled in their pyjamas, asleep in the suitcase, and a caption explaining how the Brazilian hummingbird fancier Augusto Ruschi transported them live like this in the hold of planes. He caught them and used the natural tendency of hummingbirds to go into torpor, a coma, when the temperature is lowered. This is how they conserve energy. He wrapped them in bandage-like pyjamas so they wouldn't hurt their wings if they woke, 40 of them packed next to each other. As soon as I saw the photo, it spoke to me, and I just knew I had to take this suitcase, metaphorically of course, to show my father. I guess that the 40 hummingbirds were the 40 years of my life. I was in my early 40s then. I visited my father in his tiny, dingy flat in the Latin Quarter over 2 years. For the first visit, I didn't take him a suitcase of hummingbirds, but I did show him a photo album I'd labelled The Childhood, and the little birds in their straitjackets gave me the same feeling as watching my father intently pore over those snapshots under cellophane. His flat was a few steps from the Jardin des Plantes and its menagerie, and as he was too ill in the mornings, I gravitated towards the zoo. I was happy to find many of my favourite Amazonian species there. It was only by visiting the zoo first that I could bear to see him. For the first 8 months after he reappeared, I couldn't write about him, though I knew I had to. Then one day, in the menagerie, I suddenly wrote a poem called The Zoo Father. That poem no longer exists, but it was a prototype for the whole book and gave it its title. Each stanza was a portrait of my father as an animal. I immediately saw that I could write about him through the creatures that I loved. The poems could contain my passion for the jungle I'd fallen in love with, its peoples and creatures. And in that safe arena, I could approach painful material. Memories that surfaced during my visits to his flat. I could transform the trauma. While this reunion was going on, my mother died after a lifetime of severe mental illness. She left me a trunk of letters containing terrible revelations. And by now, anyway, I had realised that I found it very hard to be with my father. Conversations of my brother brought memories to the surface. During a long phone chat, he told me about an incident, which I incorporated into this poem I'm going to read now. It's a bit fearsome, the last one. Self-portrait with fire ants. To visit you, Father, I wear a mask of fire ants. When I sit waiting for you to explain why you abandoned me when I was 8, they file in, their red bodies massing around my eyes, stinging my pupils white until I'm blind. Then they attack my mouth. I try to lick them, but they climb down my gullet until an entire swarm stings my stomach. While you must become a giant ant-eater, push your long, sticky tongue down my throat, as you once did to my baby brother, French kissing him while he pretended to sleep. I can't remember what you did to me, but the ants know. I wrote the first part of the poem about the fire ants attacking me, then abandoned it because I didn't know how to finish it. I'd read about rainforest deer and how fawns get killed by fire ants tunnelling down their throats. This captured how I felt with my father. Then, several months later, my brother told me about that incident of him being French-kissed. And when I chanced upon my abandoned poem in my notebook, I immediately knew how to finish it, by turning my father into a giant anteater. I'd seen one in the wild, in Venezuela's lost world, when I climbed Mount Roraima. I can still see that anteater all alone in the middle of that immense landscape. I don't think the poem is just a horrific image. I hope it has some affection. When my father changes into this bizarre and quite comical creature with its incredibly long nose and tongue for eating ants. It's the last line of the poem I want to focus on, though. I can't remember what you did to me, but the ants know. It came in a flash when I was writing. I'd travelled to the Venezuelan Amazon twice, not long before my father contacted me. I read, and still read, everything I can lay my hands on about the fauna, flora, geology, myths, the tribes and their shamanistic rituals, researching them felt like I was uncovering the secrets of the human soul. The ants know what happened to me in my infancy. The whole Amazon rainforest knows, because it's my childhood with its unmapped terrains. The poet and psychoanalyst D.M. Black reviewed my book in Poetry London, and he had his own theory about why I used Amazonian imagery. He said, "People who have been abused as small children often suffer from a conviction that awful things certainly happened, plus an inability to remember precisely what they were, or to distinguish fact from fantasy. To write about these early experiences can seem essential in order to objectify them, and yet doomed to frustration, because perhaps the truth can never be grasped." He went on to say that my solution to this necessary obscurity is to use the exotic imagery of the Amazon jungle in both its animal and its human life to convey the frightening, violent and faraway nature of the emotions and events described. It is this device which allows these poems to be truly created objects and rescues them from being only confessional. I'm glad D.M. Black used those words, objectify and objects, because as a poet, I'm very aware of my previous career as a sculptor. When I went to art school, I had to learn to craft an object so as to convince and suspend the viewer's disbelief. It had to work in the round, from all angles. I still think of myself as a sculptor in my poems, and the blank page a studio I walk into. The point is, though, that if I just set out to write about my feelings, expressing them alone wouldn't have done it for me. That wouldn't be therapeutic or cathartic. It's the transmutation into poetry that's important. Every step of the Zoo Father felt like I was turning my father into an artifact. But why write about it at all? Should I keep quiet? I can't. I want to explore why people do evil things and if they can be redeemed. I hope that my explorations of private trauma have a wider relevance to violence in the public sphere. Someone once said to me that the animals in my books are a kind of tribunal, and I like that idea that I was putting my father and myself on trial. The Zoo Father turns my father's dingy flat into an Amazonian rainforest, but it's an angry book. 14 years later, I started writing another book about him, with the hope that the passage of time might bring more compassion. It's titled Fovery, and although the imagery is Amazonian again, and my father is the focus, the city of Paris, where I was born, takes centre stage, especially the zoo. I called it Fovery after the French name for a big cat house, specifically the Art Deco building in the Jardin des Plantes. For me, the word conjures not just the carnivore house, but also the fauve, or wild beasts, primitive painters who used raw colour straight from the tube. I like to write with raw colour. Sometimes I work all night, or get up really early, working on the intensity and tune of my lines, until they feel like a chant, with some primitive quality, something of childhood. There's no traditional metre. I use free verse, aiming for that trance factor, influenced by incantations from the rainforest. I'm particularly drawn to initiation rites. The purpose of these rites of passage is to acquire strength and power. Some tribes have really painful ones, including the ant ritual or tocandeira, practiced by the Sotere Mawe of Brazil and the Piarau of Venezuela. Large black ants, called bullet ants, repeatedly sting the warrior undergoing the trial. Though most of the poems in Fauvery are about Paris and its zoo rather than the Amazon, some poems do offer alternative versions of ones in the Zoo Father. The ant glove in the Zoo Father enacts the male initiation rite, but by the time I wrote Fauvery, I'd read a detailed description of a trial for girls among the Pierrot. So when I remembered the moment when my father said, "What if I'd grown up with him?" How could he ask me that? But this ordeal girls have to go through conjures that moment for me. Here's the poem, and like my self-portrait with fire ants, it features ants, but this time the 24-hour ant, huge black insects with a punch like a bullet. Bullet ants. Imagine, my father says, what it would be like if you'd grown up with me. How quickly I obey, entering the elder's hut where he's the master of ritual. He's plundered the nests where girl ants work, his hands deep in their chambers. He strapped each huntress into the wicker mat, my Dianas, their thoraxes tied, legs and antennae waving. Oh, hook-clawed ones, my Amazons, your jaws that can drag a hawk wasp down the path, that carry a water drop to your queen without spilling it. What father does next is to dip the ant mat into a brew, then blow cigar smoke over you. I can hear every click of your armour, the communal buzz that soars to a shriek, the rouse of pheromones like the crack of fire as he presses you against my growing breasts, and 200 stingers stab in unison. Imagine, my father says, and I do. By ritualizing my father's scenario, it makes it safe. Here is a harm that is done to a teenage girl, but it's part of a sacred test called a marake, and my father is the head shaman applying the wicker mat with the embedded ants. The girl dances all the night before, and she drinks a lot of chicha, fermented beer, so she's prepared and numbed for the shock of the bullet-like stings. Fauvery explores the savage aspects of the City of Light. I wrote the whole book in Paris. When I stay there, I'm drawn back to the Fauvery in the Jardin des Plantes. I try not to go, because it is an obsession, but I rent a room within walking distance so I can walk along the Seine through the outdoor sculpture park and be there in 10 minutes. Feeding time is a spectacle. To see the cats active, it's best to observe them in their outdoor quarters about half an hour before la rentrée, when they become restless and impatient for their dinner, then to go inside and watch as the keepers thrust their meals through. The star of the show is Aramis, or Aramis, the black jaguar, and poems about him are threaded through the book. Even though he's black, his rosettes glow through the fur. In case you want to see him, he was a temporary resident and has since been moved to the larger zoo at Vincennes. When he pounces through the hatch and it's banged down behind him, there's always a cheer as he thuds onto the lower floor on his stocky legs. In Fauvery, there are poems about Aramis that are just about jaguarness. I cherish these purer portraits because he's such an extraordinary animal that I want to capture that and celebrate him. But there are poems where he merges with my father. I hope that by superimposing my father onto this magnificent beast, that this somehow transforms the man and excuses him. By being the beautiful apex predator with a pelt like the night sky, he can become at one with nature and just follow his creaturely but cruel instincts. I started my talk with a poem, and I'm going to end with one. Black Jaguar at twilight. He seems to have sucked the whole Amazon into his being, the storm clouds of rosettes through a bronze dusk. I've been there, sheltered under the buttress of a giant, felt the air around me, its muscles tense, stalking me as I stumbled through dense fur, my father's tongue wet on my neck as I fell into a gulch, the blackout of his mouth. And when I woke, I thought I heard the jungle cough. This jungle, the jaguar safe behind bars. I lean over and touch his cage. His glance grazes me like an arrow.
That was Pascal Petit. You can find out more about Pascal on her website at www.pascalpetit.co.uk. That's Pascal with an E. Next, here's Julia Copus with There Are Two of Me Now.
The first time I experienced severe physical pain, I was 13 years old. It was a new sensation, nauseating, deep and gnawing. Centred in my abdomen and the base of my spine, it also radiated down both legs. I lay on the floor of the lounge, on the carpeted concrete, one moment curled on my side like a comma, my knees pulled up to my chest, the next on my back, the next on my front, with my legs spread as wide as they would go. None of these positions brought relief. I was vaguely aware of shaking and of being unable to talk. My skin, I learned later, was so unnaturally pale that had I not been moving, I might have been taken for dead. More than a decade of similar episodes followed, until, age 26, I was diagnosed with endometriosis. I still have the condition today, and sometimes, in the middle of a bad episode, I have longed not to exist. But always, after the pain, comes the gradual, miraculous release from pain, and with it, the sense that my stay in that other strange realm to which illness transports us is by no means over. It seems to me that these periods are vacations, in the truest sense of the word, intermissions, voids, times in which my normal life has in effect been emptied of my presence. Most of the people in my life have never seen me suffering, but a few, ambulance staff, doctors, night cleaners, have never seen me well. It's as if, since age 13, a secret self has existed alongside my everyday self, one for whom, from time to time, the so-called real world, with all its duties and dreary preoccupations, ceases to be. It's striking how often the notion of the divided self crops up in relation to physical illness. Sometimes the division is literal, as described here by Dorothy Malloy in the title poem of her collection, Gethsemane Day. They've taken my liver down to the lab, left the rest of me here on the bed. The blood I am sweating rubs off on the sheet, but I'm still holding on to my head. Sylvia Plath also presents an account of the self splitting into two while undergoing medical treatment. In December 1952, she found herself in hospital after a skiing accident had left her with a broken leg. Her poetic response, In Plaster, details a struggle between two different selves. I shall never get out of this. There are two of me now, this new absolutely white person and the old yellow one. And the white person is certainly the superior one. Superior, it transpires, only in as much as the plaster self doesn't need food to sustain it and is whiter and unbreakable and with no complaints. But it is the old yellow self that plays host to this gleaming other. Clearly, we're in the realms of metaphor here, Plath believed that a life lived by a false self or selves was both cowardly and senseless. Time and again, her poems propound the wisdom of shedding false identities. Much has been made of the link between creativity and mental illness, but the link between physical illness and the creative life, though less discussed, is just as significant. For some artists, it led directly to a choice of career. Matisse, celebrated for his intense, saturated colours that seemed to blaze with life, initially studied law and had begun work as a court administrator when an attack of appendicitis forced him to take time out. His mother bought him art supplies to keep him occupied during his convalescence, and it was only then that he made his first paintings. His subsequent decision to quit law altogether and become a painter was, it is said, the cause of deep disappointment for his father. Hilary Mantel is a fellow endometriosis sufferer, and she believes the disease was at least partly responsible for her choice to become a writer, as she explains in an interview at the back of her memoir, Giving Up the Ghost. "A lot of people know they're going to be writers when they're children," she writes, "but I made a conscious decision to become one when I was 22, when, because of my poor health, I saw other career prospects slipping away from me." Like Matisse, Mantel read law at university, but her studies were interrupted by severe pain episodes, which resulted in a string of inappropriate medication. She explains, "It was in the nature of educated young women, it was believed, to be hysterical, neurotic, difficult, and out of control, and the object was to get them back under control by giving them drugs which make them indifferent to their mental pain, and in my case, indifferent to physical pain too." Baffled by the symptoms, Mantel's doctors seem to have resorted to a sort of wholesale annihilation of the self. Though the circumstances aren't usually so extreme, the sensation of surrendered identity is in fact a common reaction to medical intervention, as the bedridden speaker in Sylvia Plath's Tulips describes. "I have given my name and my day clothes up to the nurses, and my history to the anaesthetist, and my body to surgeons. They have propped my head between the pillow and the sheet cuff, like an eye between two white lids that will not shut." This feeling of surrendering the self to medical experts is by no means the preserve of female writers. In 2006, in County Donegal, Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney suffered a stroke, which he wrote about in his most tender collection, Human Chain. In conversation with The Observer, he explained, "The trip in the ambulance I always remember, because Mari, Heaney's wife, was in the back with me. To me, that was one of the actual beauties of the stroke, that renewal of love in the ambulance, one of the strongest, sweetest memories I have." In his poem, Chanson d'Aventure, Heaney describes that same journey. Here, the speaker's sense of powerlessness is powerfully expressed in a series of passive verbs, as he finds himself strapped on, wheeled out, forklifted, locked in position for the drive, bone-shaken, bumped at speed. Later in the same poem, Heaney finds himself reflecting on the word bell. "The one I told in Derry in my turn as college bellman, the hall of it there still in the heel of my once capable, warm hand, hand that I could not feel you lift and lag in yours throughout that journey when it lay flop heavy as a bell pull." The merging of present and past that Heaney articulates here is another familiar feature of illness. Though in the midst of severe pain, it is difficult to be anywhere except the present, during lulls in the pain or at other times of injury or shock, it is very common for different time phases to merge. Disease, then, can open up unique perspectives for the sufferer, and a surprising amount of the work that makes up our artistic canon has emerged from it, work that would otherwise never have existed. An obvious example is Paradise Lost, dictated by Milton after he'd lost his sight completely. More poignant still is the story of Mahler's Ninth Symphony. In middle age, and shortly after the death of his young daughter, Mahler learned that his heart was defective. The first movement of the symphony opens with a tentative, syncopated rhythm, which many, including Leonard Bernstein, have suggested echoes the composer's irregular heartbeat. The motif returns seven times over the course of the movement, until, at its climax, it arrives as a sudden intrusion, as Bernstein put it, of death in the midst of life. This time, it is announced by trombones, underpinned by a booming bass drum, and marked in the score mit höchster Gewalt, with the greatest violence, as if death must finally have its say. After three operations, my own worst pain episodes are few and far between, but they still occur. The most recent happened a few months ago. The two-person ambulance crew that arrived at my cottage door in the dead of night was led by a woman called Jo, for whose professionalism and compassion I shall be eternally grateful. Philip Larkin said of ambulances, "They come to rest at any curb. All streets in time are visited." According to the poem, a journey in an ambulance signaled the end, first of our identity and then our existence. Such a trip, the poem concludes, brings closer what is left to come and dulls to distance all we are. That may be true, but more often than not it is a temporary truth. Larkin's poem willfully disregards the possibility of recovery. In some ancient cultures, there is a deity for illness, which strikes me as refreshingly clear-sighted. If such a god or goddess existed for us today, I would be glad of the chance to offer up a prayer of thanks for the rich crop of art she has nurtured into being.
That was Julia Kopis. You can find out more about Julia on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 28, which was recorded by Julia Kopis and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 29, the polymathic writer Tony Gould speaks with Carol Angier about his long writing career and the different subjects it has touched on, from military history and memoir to dole cues and diseases. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.